Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking that they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. Fred and Ida had been dating a while. Fred, just 22, had had some recent bad luck with keeping a job, so their dates these days didn't consist of much. But, much to the consternation of Ida's parents, they were in love and making plans for being together for the rest of their lives. Ida didn't hold Fred's slim wallet against him. She knew he'd been trying. Fred had applied everywhere he could think of and shouldn't have had trouble getting work, especially around the shipyards where his skill as a welder should have been, in theory, highly valued. The Bay Area shipyards were booming in late 1941. War in Europe had been driving military contracts for years, and the yards were hungry for skilled workers. Fred was a skilled worker. They just didn't like his type. He had even been expelled from his union. The contract work he had managed to find had been short-lived, so their dates, his and Ida's, were humble, but that didn't matter all that much to them. They made do. Typically on Sunday mornings, they would meet and take Fred's car for a drive, park it in some picturesque place, and enjoy each other's company. This Sunday was no different as the couple headed to San Francisco's Skyline Boulevard to look down on the intoxicating beauty of the Bay Area. They had taken the thick and news-heavy San Francisco Chronicle with them to read. They knew they were living in dangerous times. Well, here, I'll let Fred tell it.
And we had spread out the Sunday magazine to just relax and had the music on, car radio. Sunday, nice sunny day. And of course we were talking mush. And all of a sudden it stopped. And they announced that Pearl Harbor was attacked. There'd been so much friction between the United States and Japan. And the way Japan was so active, going into China and doing all that, invasion and so forth, that I had a feeling that, they're just crazy enough to come down here. And that's what they did.
Just before 8 a.m. Hawaiian time, the Imperial Japanese Navy launched a surprise attack on the U.S. naval base at Pearl Harbor. In less than 2 hours, more than 2,400 Americans were dead, nearly 1,200 more were wounded, and the Pacific Fleet lay in ruins. About 20 ships and more than 300 aircraft were either destroyed or damaged. It was the deadliest foreign attack on American soil in history. And within 24 hours, the United States was at war. Fred Korematsu absorbed this news differently than some of his fellow California residents did. Fred was an American citizen, born in Oakland, the third son of Japanese-born immigrants. He had already registered, on the first day anyone could, for the peacetime draft a year earlier. Classified 4F at first because of an ulcer, he had hoped to be reclassified quickly. Ida Boitano, an American citizen as well and the daughter of Italian-born immigrants, met Fred in 1938 and things had blossomed, as things do. But December 7th, 1941 would change thousands of lives, if not literally millions worldwide, including Fred and Ida's. Within days, both of their parents' homelands would be at war with their own. For one of them, it wouldn't matter much. For the other, it would bring shame, arrest, imprisonment, ostracism, and defiance that would shape and define a lifelong struggle to prove just whose side they were on. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Home Chef.
Okay, Amber, quick one for you. When was the last time you got home at 6 p.m. and had zero plan for dinner?
Every single day until Home Chef. My favorite thing about it is the 30-minute meals. I can have real, actual dinner on the table before I even have time to panic order takeout.
That's the whole appeal. Fresh food delivered right to your door, easy recipes to follow, and it actually tastes great.
And it's not one size fits all. Home Chef's got over 30 meal options every week. Different tastes, different dietary needs, even calorie conscious and GLP-1 friendly meals.
Those GLP-1 friendly meals come with pre-portioned ingredients and dietitian approved nutrition guidelines, packed with protein rich in fiber, built to help with fullness and blood sugar stability without losing flavor.
People really do love it. Home Chef is rated number one by users of other meal kits for quality, convenience, value, taste, and recipe ease.
For a limited time, Home Chef is offering our listeners 50% off and free shipping for your first box plus free dessert for life.
Go to homechef.com/COTC. That's homechef.com/COTC for 50% off your first box and free dessert for life.
Homechef.com/COTC. Must be an active subscriber to receive free dessert.
Fred Korematsu's parents owned a flower nursery in East Oakland. They bought it in 1913 before the state made it illegal for his father, a man who had not been born in the country, to buy farmland. On December 7th, Fred had rushed home that morning to find that everyone there had already heard the news about the devastating attack on the fleet of American battleships docked at Pearl Harbor.
At the nursery, my parents, they were all around the radio listening. They weren't saying very much. My mother was crying. My father was just disgusted. All that work that my parents did to that nursery and so forth, what's going to happen?
Kakusabura Korematsu, Fred's father, had been a poor Japanese farm laborer who decided to look for better work and higher wages, first in Hawaii, then in California. The country he had chosen had not welcomed him or his fellow countrymen, seeing them as only cheap labor, ripe for exploitation, and unfit to assimilate into what was already, in the early 1900s, a multinational populace. Kakusabura had only been in the country 2 years when, pressured by groups like the Bay Area's Asiatic Exclusion League, President Theodore Roosevelt barred further immigration of Japanese laborers, something which the Japanese government had agreed was already leeching its own rural resources. Kakusabura was hardworking and quietly sure that he could make a better life in the U.S. He was not unlike other Japanese immigrants who had decided to leave Japan and start over. That influx would soon assume its own terminology. The first wave of Japanese immigrants would be collectively referred to as Issei. Their children, born on U.S. soil, were collectively referred to as Nisei. Many of those children, like Fred, had never been to Japan. Many, like Fred, weren't terribly fluent in their parents' language. And one more term you may have heard is Nikkei. It would encompass all Japanese immigrants and their descendants who established communities outside Japan. Back to Kakusabura, who arrived by himself and worked hard to get himself on solid financial footing. At 37, having established himself and a commercial venture in San Leandro, California, Kakusabura sent home for a wife. He and 22-year-old Kotsui Aoki were matched, then married by proxy in Japan in 1913. The new bride then boarded a ship to San Francisco, only to be married again on the day she arrived, courtesy of a willing and waiting Buddhist priest. Their immediate marriage had been a condition of her being allowed on American soil. The union produced 4 sons, all of whom carried Japanese names that were eventually anglicized to make them appear less foreign to their friends. Forgive my pronunciation here, but Fred's given name was Toyosaburo, literally translated as third son. An elementary teacher would dub him Fred when she found Toyosaburo too hard to pronounce. He must have liked it enough. It stuck. The assimilation into the tapestry of Bay Area life wasn't easy. Of course, the family taught their children the values they had grown up with, But the Korematsus made no effort to keep their children isolated from the larger culture. Their children went to American schools, pledging allegiance daily to the American flag. They spoke little Japanese, though the first two sons were more proficient, and all were raised as good Protestants. Fred was a Boy Scout. His friends were mostly white boys. He liked big bands and American sports. He wasn't the only Japanese-American boy who embraced a childhood most other American boys would recognize as their own. All of that did little to change the attitude of those who didn't want people like the Korematsus to be as wholly embraced as their own ancestors had been only a few decades earlier. In fact, in the 1920s, powerful Californians, like the newspaper publisher V.S. McClatchy, repeatedly warned Washington, D.C. of the dangers the Japanese posed. From reading their materials, it's clear the biggest fear the newest immigrants posed was ostensibly an economic one. Because they were industrious and ambitious and willing to put women and children to work, they might succeed in this land of plenty. According to the Equal Justice Initiative, by 1917, Japanese immigrants produced 75% of the vegetables that Los Angeles residents ate. Some powerful people were scared the immigrants' economic power was going to rise even more, so they pushed and got passed anti-Asian laws, including that no one of Japanese heritage could own land in California. 16 other states peppered throughout the country followed suit. FYI, the Florida statute remained on the books until 2018. Yikes. Anyway, the laws and attitudes never said the quiet part out loud, which was that it was all fueled by racial prejudice and a belief that these new people were simply not good fits for assimilation. The Nisei, again, those of Japanese lineage, were increasingly singled out as different from the white culture that had, more or less, absorbed Germans, Italians, Irish, Scandinavians, Slavs, and anyone else whose ancestors had crossed the Atlantic from Europe. That early century fear even had a name, the Yellow Peril. In her book, Enduring Conviction, Lorraine K. Bonai explained that the Japanese threat seen by so many was remarkably unfounded, if only because, in 1930, they represented a mere 2.1% of the total population of California and only 0.1% of the population of the entire country. That same year, Chinese Americans faced equally harsh marginalization, and they also represented just 0.1% of the U.S. population, largely due to the passage of the Chinese Exclusion Act. You get the picture. But know that Japan had done their departing expats no favors by causing havoc abroad. It had aggressively and militarily pushed beyond its borders, it needed resources to keep growing, and invading first Manchuria in 1931, then Shanghai in 1932. This was followed by the atrocity-filled 1937 invasion of China. Then, fueled by nationalism and dreams of expanded empire, Japan attacked the U.S. naval base in Hawaii in 1941, a direct attack on America's sovereignty, even though Hawaii was still only a territory. Now the country, which had already shunned and isolated its Japanese-American neighbors, claimed to have an excuse for doing so. Months before the attack, Fred Korematsu had already felt that exclusion as he struggled to find work. On that horrible December day, President Franklin Roosevelt issued Proclamation 2525, which declared every Japanese national within the United States to be, quote-unquote, alien enemies. This meant they could be immediately detained and restricted per an act of Congress passed in 1798. To be fair, this was followed by declarations 2526 and 2527 that included those who had been born in Germany and Italy as similarly dangerous. On the next day, on Monday, FDR gave his historic speech. You know the one.
A date which will live in infamy.
We were now at war with Japan. On December 11th, after Germany declared war on the U.S. per its treaty with Japan, we were also at war with the Third Reich and its ally, Italy. On December 13th, this headline appeared in the Sacramento Bee. Japanese are advised not to form crowds. Dateline San Francisco, the story from the United Press, explained that the Japanese American Citizens League, the JACL, was, quote, advising the Japanese community to avoid public places and amusement such as theaters and not to congregate on streets, end quote. It went on to explain that bank accounts of Issei had been closed and all Nisei should carry identification such as birth certificates on them at all times. 2 days later, on December 15th, 1941, the San Francisco Examiner, in its notes around the state column, informed that, quote, from the coast, a friend writes that there are more than 1,000 battered and creaky old roadsters owned by Japanese gardeners who putter around the gardens of the best homes in Beverly Hills. These little rake and hoe men all had their little notebooks, in which, among other things, they keep records of the money due to them. Recently, two of these books picked up by the authorities were found to contain fairly accurate outlines of the Santa Monica Mountains, which face the Pacific Ocean and are said to be thoroughly fortified, end quote. The point of the story was to suggest that the Nikkei were now spying on the rest of us. Shortly thereafter, according to author Banai, multiple California newspapers informed their readers that, quote, Japanese gardeners were said to be equipped with short-wave transmitters hidden in garden hoses. Japanese servants and laborers who failed to appear for work on December 7th were accused of prior knowledge of the Hawaii attack. Japanese farmers were charged with smuggling poison into vegetables bound for market. And a number of anxious Californians, according to one report, went so far as to plow up a beautiful field of flowers on the property of a Japanese farmer because it seems the Jap was a fifth columnist and had grown his flowers in a way that, when viewed from a plane, formed an arrow pointing the direction of the airport. End quote. To be clear, this was all hysteria, and the hysteria was spreading. By December 17th, the Associated Press was reporting that Culbert Olson, the Democratic governor of California, was already floating the idea of using Chino State Prison as a concentration camp for alien Japanese. He figured they could farm vegetables while there. A few Americans took matters into their own hands. In the first 3 months after the attack, U.S. Attorney General Francis Biddle reported at least 36 people who appeared to be Japanese had been robbed, raped, murdered, or assaulted. By January 1942, newspaper columnists and lower-level public servants were asking Congress to remove the Japanese from California public life, not for their own safety, but in service of the war effort. Worse, said civil rights attorney and scholar Peter Irons,
there were reports in the press, wild and absolutely false stories, that there had been acts of sabotage or espionage. Japanese Americans who were signaling to submarines off the coast with flashlights, and that allowed the government to cast them as dangerous alien enemies.
Even those who might have been expected to be less reactionary, like California Attorney General Earl Warren, who later became the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, let it be known he wanted all Japanese expelled from the Golden State. Yeah, but funny thing, the FBI's J. Edgar Hoover wasn't convinced this was necessary. U.S. Attorney General Biddle wasn't convinced either. But Roosevelt was, I guess. On February 19th, 1942, he issued Executive Order 9066, authorizing the U.S. military to designate military areas from which certain persons could be excluded. It was an open-ended and dangerously vague order, one which Lieutenant General John L. DeWitt took as his carte blanche okay to start moving Nikkei to relocation centers that had not even been built yet. DeWitt was head of the Western Defense Command located at the Presidio Army Base in San Francisco. The military's rather benign definition of what was a military necessity was effectively decided to be a rather large area, the entire state of California. He justified this to Secretary of War Henry Stimson by saying he had indications that American Nikkei were planning and organizing ways in which to aid their native land. This is particularly disingenuous, said Liz Melliker, curator at the Presidio, because
one of the ironies of the Presidio's role in the mass incarceration of Japanese Americans is that less than a mile away from where Lieutenant General DeWitt is signing the civilian exclusion orders, the Army here at the Presidio was running a military intelligence language school, training Japanese Americans in the Japanese language to act as part of the war effort.
And who was in charge of that intelligence training effort? Well, General DeWitt. Still, DeWitt emphatically said, even before the order was issued, that he had no confidence in the loyalty of the Japanese. A year later, he would reiterate that position, adding that he had no such fear that those whose parentage could be traced to Italy or Germany, except maybe in individual cases. As for the Japanese, DeWitt said, we must worry, quote, until he is wiped off the map. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Bioptimizers.
Amber, how's your sleep been this summer? Because mine's been rough.
Same. It's the middle of summer, long days, hot nights, and I feel like everyone I know is sleeping worse than usual.
Here's something most people don't think about. Summer quietly drains your magnesium, and magnesium is what your body relies on to relax and recover.
That's why I keep Magnesium Breakthrough by Bioptimizer on my nightstand all summer. I've loved the flavors I've tried, and what makes it different is it packs multiple bioavailable forms of magnesium into one capsule instead of just the one or two you get in most supplements.
So whether you're coming off a long travel day, bouncing back from a hot, active afternoon, or just trying to actually get some rest on a warm night, this is the simplest habit to come back to.
Here's what you get when you go to bioptimizers.com/COTC and use code COTC, 15% off your entire order.
Plus a free travel-size bottle of Masszymes, Bioptimizers' best-selling digestive enzyme, added to your order automatically when you use our exclusive code. That's a $20 product free on top of your discount. This is a limited time offer while supplies last.
You cannot get this on Amazon. You can't get it in stores. This offer exists in one place. My link, my code, that's it.
Bioptimizers, breakthrough science, results you can feel.
On March 2nd, 1942, General John L. DeWitt's first order went out, referred to simply as Proclamation 1. It advised all those of Japanese extraction in Western Washington, Western Oregon, Western California, and Southern Arizona that they were to leave their homes, their land, their businesses, and go elsewhere where they'd be forcibly removed. This served not only to desperately alarm and panic the already frightened Japanese American population, but to effectively shame it into submission. They were shocked to discover they were to be treated as disloyal strangers at best. At worst, they were to be viewed as traitors, even spies and saboteurs, willing to kill their neighbors as soon as the opportunity arose. Fred's plaintive response?
I thought the exclusion order would be only for aliens and those that were born in Japan. I didn't think that the government would go as far as to include American citizens.
His daughter Karen later said the proclamation seared him irrevocably. He didn't see why he should go to a prison camp when he had done nothing wrong and simply wanted to live like any other American. Other proclamations followed. This is Derek Chang, associate professor of history at Cornell University.
Public Proclamation number 3 also restricted the daytime movements of these folks, right, enemy aliens and persons of Japanese ancestry, to, quote, not more than 5 miles from their place of residence. This was the first directive, the first order, to violate directly the civil liberties of Japanese Americans. In the meantime, Roosevelt had established the War Relocation Authority, the WRA, by executive order on March 18th to oversee the building and administration of detention camps. And Congress had passed Public Law 503 on March 21st to establish sanctions for those who violated Executive Order 9066.
This is known in the legislative vernacular as the enabling legislation. In other words, we mean it. Across the nation, everyday Americans made their support of the government's stance known. Some hung signs on their businesses and even homes with phrases like, "Japs keep moving, this is a white man's neighborhood, and we don't want any Japs back here ever." Some 5,000 or so Nikkei left voluntarily because they had somewhere to go. But the vast majority of those affected had no choice but to wait to be rounded up and herded into camps. There, they would be surrounded by barbed wire, guarded by armed soldiers, and denied access to outside lawyers. In other words, to hell with both the 4th and 14th Amendments of the Constitution, which granted citizenship to all those born or naturalized in the U.S., this included former enslaved people, and guaranteed equal protection and due process under the law. 120,000 people were eventually incarcerated. Of those, two-thirds were American citizens who, like Fred, had been born here. According to the Smithsonian, half of those incarcerated were children. The Japanese American Citizens League, the JACL, attempted to give its communities some guidance on how to respond. They urged compliance. If this is what the military required of loyal citizens, they said, the community would prove its loyalty by refusing to complain. Not everyone affected thought this was a wise stance, but the recourse was limited. For what it's worth, under Executive Order 9066 and its incumbent proclamations, anyone with as little as 1/16th Japanese blood was subject to incarceration. The specific order targeting all persons of Japanese ancestry residing in southern Alameda County, California, that is, the Korematsus and their neighbors, was posted on March 3, 1942. Civilian Exclusion Order 34 had been nailed to a telephone pole and posted in the post office and in store windows in San Leandro. It ominously stated that buses and soldiers would be on their way to collect all of those of Japanese lineage on May 8th at the City Plaza in Hayward. The Korematsus, like all of the others, were given a few days to get their affairs in order. They were told they could only take to these camps what they could carry. A few families were able to store their worldly goods with Caucasian friends who agreed, but most had to leave everything. The American propaganda machine was hard at work, releasing news clips of smiling Japanese Americans waving from trains to onlookers as though they were setting off on vacation.
The evacuees cooperated wholeheartedly. The many loyal among them felt that this was a sacrifice they could make in behalf of America's war effort.
The Korematsus put the nursery in the hands of a neighbor and hoped for the best. Fred, who had returned home to weather the days immediately following the attack, told his parents some sobering news. He was not going to comply with the order. Instead, he told them he and Ida would move away, outside of the state, out of the exclusion zone. They would marry in a state that allowed interracial marriage, which California forbade. His appalled parents told him to do what he wanted. His brothers made it known that, by doing so, he was heaping more shame on their family. Ida, however, wasn't eager to leave California, or more tellingly, her parents, so Fred rented a room in Oakland and tried to come up with a plan that would keep the couple together. Ida told Fred she had seen this advertisement for plastic surgery and, you know, maybe he could do something to soften the facial characteristics that made others identify him as Asian. A dubious Fred let himself be swayed. Later, he would tell the FBI that he did so because he feared that if he and Ida married and people found out he was Japanese, that she might be subject to violent attacks. The doctor promised to remove the folds of his upper eyelids and alter his nose sufficiently to erase his ethnicity. Fred paid $100 to little effect. He basically just managed to slightly straighten a previously broken nose. It was a costly misstep. Needing money to support his idea of marrying Ida, Fred then decided to change his name on his identification and draft cards. He chose to call himself Clyde Sarah. He thought it sounded vaguely Spanish-Hawaiian. Implausible as it sounds now, that was his story, and he was sticking to it, knowing full well that, after May 9th, he would be living and working in an area from which he was legally banned. He'd be a criminal in plain sight. And it worked. For a bit. He got a job. He would later say it made him feel like an American. He could roam the streets unmolested, take Ida on dates, take the bus. He felt he was invisible. Until Memorial Day, May 30th, only 3 weeks after his family had been whisked away to a temporary assembly center camp at Tanforan Racetrack in San Bruno.
And then one day my girlfriend wanted to meet me. I was waiting for her at the corner and she didn't show up. I ran out of cigarettes. So like a darn fool, I went across the street to the drugstore and someone recognized me, I assumed, because when I came back and I was standing there for another 5 minutes, then the police came and they looked around and looked at me and says, "Do you see any short Japanese person around here, Asian?" I said, "No." They looked at me and says, "Well, let me see your identification." By that time, the two MPs came in the military and said, "We have to take you to the city hall."
He was taken to the San Leandro jail. His arrest made the papers. Then the FBI showed up to talk to him. He said he just wanted to be with his girl. It was very sweet and hardly fiery anti-American political speech. The FBI, not yet with the overall Japanese vilification agenda, wrote in their report that he only wanted, quote, "to live as normal people," end quote. But he had broken the law. So Fred was sent to the Presidio, the military installation on the San Francisco Peninsula on what is now national parkland at the south end of the Golden Gate Bridge. He figured he'd get some kind of hearing and thought he would just talk himself out of this mess. He'd have to do it himself, see, because he couldn't afford an attorney. Then, Ernest Besig showed up. He was an attorney and the executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Northern California. He told a concerned Fred that he would work for free if Fred agreed to be a test case. That is, would Fred let the ACLU challenge the presidential order and the vast overreach of the American military, even if it meant hard days ahead, multiple trips to court, and likely a hearing in front of the U.S. Supreme Court? Besig said it was not a sure thing. But he, for one, thought the entire anti-Japanese hysteria and its resultant legislation was patently unconstitutional. He told Fred that they were likely alone here because the JACL had not exactly stepped up to the plate, and most every Japanese leader was already in one of the camps. He did not tell Fred that his own ACLU chapter had been polled and had supported Roosevelt's Executive Order 9066 by 144-84 margin, and that, when asked if they should pursue a test case to challenge that executive order, the membership had voted 120-117 against the idea. Besig was plowing ahead anyway, but could only do so with Fred's agreement. Naive, perhaps, but angry now, Fred was all in. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Wayfair.
Every time I come home, it seems like there's another item from Wayfair here.
I really like them. They make finding and ordering and, when necessary, returning so easy that it's tough to go anywhere else. Do you know what one of my favorite items is?
Do tell.
On the bird porch, where I hang out with my parrots every day, there's a hammock out there. I got that from Wayfair, and it's perfect.
Why'd you get it from Wayfair?
Well, the price, but also the style options. I found one that I thought was fine somewhere else, but Wayfair had so many more options that I found one there that I loved. I'd been hunting everywhere, but this one was a style I liked at a price I couldn't beat, and the delivery was so seamless, I didn't even think twice before ordering more.
You've gotten more than just the hammock, though, right?
Oh my gosh, yes. A couple of coffee tables, my first real adult dresser, a credenza for my office, different rooms, totally different styles, all from one place.
That's kind of the whole point. Seating, storage, lighting, decor, you're not bouncing between five different stores.
Like, if a friend was putting off redoing their space because of price and not knowing where to even start, I would tell them, just go look.
Ready to upgrade your home for way less? Head to Wayfair.com right now to shop all things home and get your space ready for less.
That's Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
On June 12, 1942, Fred Korematsu was charged with breaking the law by staying in a military area which he had been told was off limits to him. Besig paid the bail money out of his own pocket so that Fred might walk the streets again. However, upon leaving the San Francisco courtroom that day, Fred was rearrested on its steps. Same charges, same trip back to the Presidio. Fred was then taken to the Tanfren racetrack to join his parents. There, he found them living in mucked-out horse stalls that smelled of manure and were overrun by rats. They were sleeping on straw-filled mattresses, eating bad food, and making do. They'd been interrogated and fingerprinted. They had a single light bulb hanging in the stall, no books, no radio, and no cooking source. Fred was ostracized as if he had shamed the entire Japanese-American community. His parents and brothers were especially offended by his arrest and continuing stance against the internment. When he was put to work, he chose to do so at night so he might escape the daily public rejection. He had written Ida, who had written him back, but that continued for only a little while. After talking to the FBI, the San Leandro police, and to Besig, she wrote Fred that continuing to keep in contact would put her in danger. He stopped writing for fear she was right. They never saw or spoke to each other again. In the summer of 1942, before his scheduled September 8th appearance before U.S. District Judge Adolphus St. Cyr, the ACLU had informed Besig and his cohorts fighting the case that they were forbidden to argue that Roosevelt's executive order was unconstitutional. That is, the ACLU stood fast that the president's authority in time of war was not subject to question. It was unconstitutional, Fred's lawyers insisted, because this order and these proclamations were entirely based on race, something the 14th Amendment had made clear was unacceptable. Even Alfonso J. Zierpoli, the assistant U.S. attorney assigned to prosecute Fred, told the judge he had absolutely no evidence that any Japanese American had committed or even threatened sabotage or espionage. I should mention that while the West Coast was the prime target of rumors and thus punishment, the Japanese Americans elsewhere were subject to frequent arrest, surveillance, and incarceration. One of the detainment sites was Ellis Island, the same place that had welcomed so many immigrants decades earlier. Now, as Fred's case barreled toward trial, amicus briefs were filed right and left, with the GACL still supporting the wholesale incarceration of an entire region's Japanese-linked inhabitants. The only defense available to Besig was to show that Fred was a loyal American-born man who regularly voted, registered for the draft, and would gladly fight today if someone would send him. But unconvinced though he was, Zierpoli had a job to do, and he did it. He argued the only thing he could. Let me quote, "Because of the peculiar racial characteristics of these sons and daughters of Nippon, they have not been assimilated into the community life of the population inhabiting this area. their manners of thought and action, their traditional life patterns, and their adherence to their Oriental origins combined to make of them a people apart. That the presence in this area of this unassimilated group of blood relatives of a nation with which the people of this country are now engaged in mortal combat gave ample opportunity for sabotage and fifth column activity, none can gainsay, end quote. Fred was convicted and sentenced to 5 years of probation. Judge St. Schur added that the, quote, pronouncing of judgment be suspended, end quote. Whatever that meant. Fred went back to the so-called relocation center. That same month, all those who had been housed in horse stalls at Taniffer were moved to the compound in Topaz, Utah, a brittle, dry, dusty, and remote desert outpost where, yes, you can find topaz crystals in the volcanic rock. The Korematsus were assigned to a single room in a multi-room barrack where all families shared showers, toilets, a dining area, and laundry facilities. It could be hot during the day and cold at night, or hot all the time or cold all the time. There was no breeze ever. There was no heat provided. But the community rallied to school their children, scratch gardens out of the soil, run an arts center, and publish a camp newspaper, the Topaz Times. While they labored at the camp in a maintenance role, they earned $12 a month. Professionals who provided services, such as medical ones, were paid $19 a month. On April 11, 1943, while living at the Topaz camp, James Hatsuwaki Wakasa was shot and killed while walking his dog. Here's the memory of witness Roy Ibihara, who was 9 years old back in the day, as presented by the Wakasa Memorial Committee.
A friend and I happened to cross paths with him as we were heading back to the barracks. Suddenly, we heard a series of pop, pop, like firecrackers behind us, and we just ran as fast as we could, never looking back. My mother took me to the funeral service, and seeing Mr. Wakasa lying in the casket and the singing of the hymn, Rock of Ages, had haunted me for years. Bad memories are hard to erase.
The military maintained he had attempted to leave the relocation center at an unauthorized and unguarded place and was only shot at after he was repeatedly challenged and failed to respond. But Mr. Wakasa was deaf and, per witnesses, within the fence when he was shot. The Topaz internees refused to accept the official explanation, but their own fear kept their outrage in check. The news of the death spread to other countries, some of which, most notably Spain, asked the State Department to look into the matter. They responded that they already had. Meanwhile, things got weird. Fred's lawyers were appealing the judgment, but endless delays were caused by that odd wording of St. Schur's, suspending the pronouncing of judgment, and the judge's unwillingness to change that wording. Fred waited at Topaz, but was making his own plans as he could. A little-known fact about the internment camps is that some of the able-bodied young prisoners were able to obtain seasonal leave as laborers on America's farms, not located in the far west. And sure, they had to report back to their military overseers as to their movements, but they could leave the confines of the tiny rooms and bad food and go out into an America that hated them. Fred was allowed to work in Colorado, Salt Lake City, and ultimately Detroit. He lived at the local YMCA there and worked making doors for, among other things, aircraft hangars, as his California lawyers were fighting the good fight, one brief, one motion, one plea at a time. On December 2, 1943, as expected, the Ninth Circuit affirmed Fred's conviction. Meanwhile, all through 1942 and 1943, General DeWitt had been asked to issue a report on his military justifications for his series of evacuation proclamations. The 618-page document, largely written by then-Colonel Carl Benditson, revealed DeWitt's belief that hundreds of Japanese organizations had been established near strategic American military installations before December 7, 1941, expressly to help the emperor triumph. He claimed thousands had been indoctrinated to be pro-Japan and had been taught to worship the emperor. He claimed Japanese Americans were regularly signaling offshore Japanese vessels to aid their cause. He charged them as well with radio transmissions that could be intercepted by the Japanese vessels and forwarded to Hirohito. And he stated in no uncertain terms that, and I'm quoting here, "the Japanese race is an enemy race," end quote. This was an explosive report. 10 copies of it were circulated in Washington, D.C., and met with considerable dismay. All but one of those copies was retrieved. The 9 that were made public, but only after heavy redactions. Somewhat explosively, the GACL issued their own 200-page report on the evacuations. This time, they begged to differ about the characterization of their own people as DeWitt saw them. They now believed the exclusion orders were based upon the general's extreme racism and his willingness to believe unfounded rumors. On October 11, 1944, the Supreme Court heard Fred's appeal of the Ninth Circuit's decision. A large audience was on hand. Solicitor General Charles Fahey argued the government's case and was questioned by Vienna-born Justice Felix Frankfurter about DeWitt's report, which was serving as the government's proof of quote-unquote military necessity. Frankfurter asked if the orders were the result of racism or had they been truly necessary. Fahey argued the decision was not DeWitt's alone, but one made by the whole of the U.S. government. For what it's worth, Fahey also argued that those interned at the camps were not prisoners and that the camps themselves were only provided as a last resort after voluntary relocation efforts had failed. 2 months later, the court upheld the constitutionality of the orders and affirmed Fred's conviction in the process. The vote was 6-3. The written opinion of the majority said that the court's job wasn't to conduct wars. That was in the hands of others. In writing for the minority, Justice Owen Roberts objected to that. He wrote that this was a case, quote, "of convicting a citizen as a punishment for not submitting to imprisonment in a concentration camp based on his ancestry and solely because of his ancestry, without evidence or inquiry concerning his loyalty and good disposition toward the United States," end quote. Justice Frank Murphy agreed, saying the whole case, quote, "fell into the ugly abyss of racism," end quote. Murphy wrote he found no reasonable relation to an immediate, imminent, or impending public danger that would require such a lapse in a citizen's rights. Justice Robert Jackson added, as if for emphasis, quote, "guilt is personal and not inheritable," end quote. Two other cases, Hirabayashi v. United States and Yasui v. United States, had taken on similar breaches, and still, the High Court remained silent on the legality of incarcerating American citizens who had tenuous genetic ties to a land quite far away. The matter, however, was becoming increasingly less pressing. The Allies were obviously winning the war now, and loyalty screenings in the camps allowed some of those in prison to return home if they had one. Fred's parents went home on May 28, 1945, 3 months before the Japanese surrendered. For the 3 years they had spent in prison behind barbed wire, the government gave them recompense of $25 each. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Drip Drop. I have been drinking Drip Drop for a long time now, way before they became a sponsor.
I can attest. You make sure we keep some on hand in the house, and you insist that we pack it when we travel.
That is absolutely true. I have a little travel routine worked out, and I know I get super dehydrated when flying or on road trips, so I always have a Drip Drop afterward, and I don't feel so rough.
It's proven fast hydration, built for busy days, long workouts, summer travel, all of it. Because hydration isn't just something you do when you're behind, it's how you stay ahead.
It also uses science-based formulas for rapid hydration so you feel results while getting 3 times the electrolytes of leading sports drinks.
It's not just for athletes either. Trusted by firefighters, medical professionals, and over 90% of top college and pro sports teams. Drip Drop Zero Sugar Plus is a breakthrough formula with an advanced blend of 6 key electrolytes, 15 essential vitamins and nutrients, and no sugar or artificial sweeteners.
And it tastes good. There are 16 original flavors and 8 Zero Sugar Plus options. My favorite's the watermelon. I keep it on my desk, not just for the gym. Right now, Drip Drop is offering podcast listeners 20% off your first order. Go to dripdrop.com and use promo code COTC.
That's dripdrop.com, promo code COTC for 20% off.
Stock up now at dripdrop.com and use promo code COTC. After their release from an internment camp, Fred Korematsu's family returned to the East Bay. The people who had been put in charge of their nursery had let it founder, so Fred's father borrowed money and remade it into a going enterprise. Fred stayed in Detroit, a city that boomed during the war years and had welcomed his hard work. He married Catherine Pearson, a white South Carolinian, in their adopted state of Michigan, where such unions were allowed. When Fred's mother became increasingly infirm, they moved back to California. Life was harder for a mixed-race couple, but they managed. They had 2 children, and life went on. The law Fred had meant to change was still on the books. Racism was still an accepted constitutional reason for depriving someone, or many someones, from enjoying the full range of freedoms guaranteed to American citizens. The civil rights movement took serious hold in the 1960s and new laws were passed, and yet the Korematsu decision remained. Legal scholars looked for ways to fix that. In 1976, President Gerald Ford officially rescinded Executive Order 9066 and Congress repealed Public Law 503. Ford called it unfortunate. Then, in 1981, young legal scholar Peter Irons used a Freedom of Information Act request to take a fresh look at Justice Department documents concerning the case.
It was a memorandum from a Justice Department lawyer, Edward Ennis. And Mr. Ennis said, "I have obtained records all showing that no acts of espionage or sabotage had ever been verified. And I found more records backing that up." It was one of those holy cow moments.
Holy cow, because the memo, dated September 30th, 1944, proved that the Justice Department knew Solicitor General Fahey was going to lie to the Supreme Court about any wartime threat posed by Japanese Americans. Ennis had even warned Fahey that he had an express ethical obligation not to do so. Irons also found a memo from J. Edgar Hoover to the Attorney General addressing DeWitt's final report on the Japanese evacuation from the West Coast, the same report the government had leaned on to justify its actions. Hoover restated his position and told the AG that the FBI had investigated all alleged espionage claims and could find no proof that they had occurred. The Supreme Court was not told of Hoover's memo either. Benai wrote in the ensuing days, more documents were found that, quote, showed that the government had purposefully suppressed, altered, and destroyed material evidence during World War II to ensure that the Supreme Court upheld the wartime curfew, forced removal, and, if it reached that issue, incarceration. The government had, in sum, engineered a win based on a false and fraudulent record and had lied to the court. The government had withheld from the court key intelligence reports at odds with its claim that its actions were justified by military necessity, end quote. And remember how 9 out of 10 copies of DeWitt's final report were gathered back up by the government? Well, I'm not great at math, but counting on my fingers tells me that means one copy remained. And sure enough, it was unearthed. The blatant racism within provided more evidence of a cover-up that served, in the end, to undermine Fred's case. Fahey had lied when he told the court that he knew nothing that would refute DeWitt's claims. Soon, Peter Irons was joined by a phalanx of civil rights lawyers and, in January 1983, filed a writ of error coram nobis. Now, I'm not quoting the Latin here, but that's fancy legalese for, come on, admit you were wrong. Literally, dozens of legal associations, religious organizations, student assemblies, advocacy groups, and even the JACL wrote amicus briefs in support. The government delayed a bit, not really wanting to defend the indefensible, so it asked Fred if he would be happy instead with a pardon. This is federal judge Marilyn Hall Patel, who eventually would rule on the case.
Well, of course, a pardon has a certain connotation to it, that you did something that was wrong, but your government is willing to forgive you for it.
Dale Minami, one of Fred's attorneys, said that didn't sit well with his client.
Fred Korematsu told me, he said, we shouldn't accept a pardon. If anything, we should pardon the government.
The case was going to be heard. U.S. Attorney Victor Stone represented the government. In anticipation of the large crowd expected to watch, Judge Patel moved the proceedings to a much larger courtroom. Among the many in the courtroom that day were survivors who had been incarcerated 40 years earlier. Stone began by saying he did not want Judge Patel to issue a sweeping decision. He said, "Let's let bygones be bygones." Attorney Minami asked Stone if he was worried about the feelings of those who had suffered or those who had lied. Then Fred spoke. He asked the court to overturn his conviction, arguing that what had been done to him could be done to any American who looked different or came from the wrong background. The relief he was seeking, he said, wasn't just for himself, it was for the country. The judge let him finish, then she immediately rendered her decision.
I concluded after looking at all of the facts that they had done something tantamount to confessing error. And when the government does in fact come in and confess error, even though they don't say in those magic incantation words, we confess error, they had done substantially the same thing.
It was a great moment for Fred, whose conviction was set aside. But he knew, as did his attorneys, that the judge had not overturned the Supreme Court decision. She didn't have the power to. So Fred wasn't done. Others joined with him, lobbying Congress, educating voters, doing all they could to finish what Fred had started in 1942. Then in 1987, when Ronald Reagan was president, a bill was introduced into Congress to provide a national apology and some kind of monetary recompense for the suffering of so many. The bill was, rather appropriately, dubbed H.R. 442, a nod to the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, an elite World War II fighting unit made up almost exclusively of American-born Japanese that won 21 Medals of Honor and more than 9,000 Purple Hearts for their service in the European theater. On August 10, 1988, Reagan, a former governor of California, issued these comments.
We must recognize that the internment of Japanese Americans was just that, a mistake. For throughout the war, Japanese Americans in the tens of thousands remained utterly loyal to the United States. The legislation that I am about to sign provides for a restitution payment to each of the 60,000 survivors. Surviving Japanese Americans of the 120,000 who were relocated or detained. Yet no payment can make up for those lost years. So what is most important in this bill has less to do with property than with honor. For here we admit a wrong. Here we reaffirm our commitment as a nation to equal justice under the law.
Standing beside Reagan that day was U.S. Senator Daniel Inouye, a Medal of Honor winner who lost an arm while serving with the 442nd. Also on hand was Congressman Norman Mineta, who was 10 when he was interned and kept under guard for 3 years. It was a celebratory day, and yet the Supreme Court decision stood. In 2017, President Donald Trump signed Executive Order 13769, restricting travel to the U.S. from 7 predominantly Muslim nations on what he termed national security grounds. The policy was challenged, and Trump v. Hawaii made its way to the Supreme Court. The court ultimately decided the travel ban was lawful and could remain in effect. Justice Sonia Sotomayor disagreed, comparing the wholesale bans to the wartime internments. Chief Justice Roberts wasn't having it. In the court's decision, he wrote, quote, Korematsu, meaning the decision, not the man, was gravely wrong when it was decided and has no place in law under the Constitution, end quote. He said it had been appropriately overruled in the so-called court of history. Civil rights advocates consider that a bit of a hollow victory. Fred had died in 2005, and the overturning had done little good, coming as it did as an addendum to another presidential order based on racist assumptions. But advocates had done other work, too. In 2010, the state of California passed legislation marking the day, January 30th, and all January 30ths to follow, as Fred Korematsu Day. Karen Korematsu, Fred and Catherine's daughter, had by then taken up the mantle for her father. In 2009, in partnership with the Asian Law Caucus, she founded the Fred Korematsu Institute, a national education advocacy organization designed to advance racial equality and social justice. Early on, looking for a place for the Institute's offices, she had one thought. It would please her father if it were permanently housed at the Presidio. And so it is. To research this case, journalist Amy Wilson read Lorraine K. Banai's Enduring Conviction, Fred Korematsu and His Quest for Justice. She watched and referenced the Korematsu Institute's documentary of Civil Wrongs and Rights and Professor Derek Chang's 2013 lecture on the book When the Emperor Was King, which was assigned to all of Cornell University's entering freshmen that year. The San Francisco Chronicle and San Francisco Examiner archives also proved quite helpful. Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through Grabbag Collab. Head to www.grabbagcollab.com for exclusive content related to this show and access to other series on our profit-sharing network. Unless noted in the citations, this case was researched and written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced by Henry Lavoie. Original music is by Bruce Hunt, Andrew Higley, and sometimes my child, Hunt Van Benskoten. Other music comes from Epidemic Sound. If you like the show, please help us out by rating and reviewing on Apple Podcasts. Also, tell your friends. For more information or to recommend a case, go to centuriespod.com. On Instagram, we're @centuriespod, and you can find us on the Crimes of the Centuries Facebook page.